Democratic Party. But it's also likely due to the fact that elected officials in Puerto Rico these days have little real power, since Congress imposed an outside financial control board more than 4 years ago. So what happened with this election? Well, first, the referendum was controversial because, unlike several status votes in the past, it gave only a choice of one status. It asked a yes or no vote on statehood for Puerto Rico. So voters had to choose either the current status or the control board colony. I'm sorry, the control board colony or statehood. It was, in short, a rigged referendum with no choice of independence or the current Commonwealth or even free association. But because it was scheduled during a regular election, many voters were going to the polls anyway, and statehood ended up with about 52% of the vote. No one expects Congress to grant statehood, however, even though an increasing number of Democrats and billionaire hedge fund types are pressing for statehood as a way to increase potential Democratic votes in the U.S. House and the Senate. But the truly historic change came in the regular election.
Juan, we have 10
seconds. An unprecedented number of voters deserted the dinosaur duopoly of the pro-statehood and pro-Commonwealth parties that has alternated in power in Puerto Rico for the last 60 years.
Juan,
several
we have
minor
to leave it
parties
there.
ended up grabbing a third of all the votes cast. The pro-statehood Progressive Party.
Juan, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue to cover this next week, and you can check all the latest news at democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Guess what? It's fall, so that means it's time for KBOO's annual membership meeting. Join us Saturday, November 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. via Zoom to hear updates about the station, meet candidates running for 4 open board seats, and participate in a lively discussion about KBOO in the year 2020 and beyond. Featuring performing artists Scooter Rogers, Rain Ezra, and host Trista Tyree. To get the link for the meeting, register online by visiting our website kboo.fm/meeting2020. That's kboo.fm/meeting2020.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council voted down an $18 million reduction to the Portland Police Bureau's budget. A Troutdale man with a connection to ISIS has been charged with terrorism. And Governor Brown issues new COVID rules as the case count continues to rise. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 6th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. The Portland City Council struck down a proposed $18 million budget cut to the Portland Police on Wednesday with a final vote of 3-2. The rejected proposal was drawn up by Commissioner Joanne Hardesty and followed a council cut of $15 million from PPB's budget back in June. That reduction redirected police budget money into other city programs and initiatives. Prior to the vote, Portland Police Chief Chuck Lavelle expressed concerns that the additional cuts would result in layoffs, increased response times, and an inability to respond to 911 calls. The commissioners who voted no said that more comprehensive discussions were needed before moving forward with the proposal, citing concerns over destabilizing the Bureau and undermining public safety. Voting for the proposal had been set for last week, but was stalled after several hours of public testimony when three council members said they needed more time to consider it. Hardesty pushed for the proposal, saying the $18 million would be reallocated to emergency food programs, support systems for the houseless community, and for renter protection. Both Hardesty and Commissioner Chloe Udaly voted in favor of the proposal on Wednesday, while Commissioners Amanda Fritz and Dan Ryan, as well as Mayor Ted Wheeler, opposed the initiative. Hardesty expressed disappointment in the three members that voted down her proposal, saying they were continuing to uphold the status quo and they were letting down Portlanders who had been protesting nightly for police accountability and change. Hardesty said, quote, It is disappointing that the status quo will reassert itself in this process. So we'll continue to talk about Black lives, but we won't actually do anything to make these Black lives better. A small group of protesters marched to Portland Commissioner Dan Ryan's home yesterday in response to the failure of the city council to vote for an amendment proposed by Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. Ryan, a recently elected commissioner, joined his colleagues, Commissioner Amanda Fritz and Mayor Ted Wheeler, to vote down the proposed $18 million reduction to the Portland Police Bureau's budget. For months, demonstrators in Portland have demanded police reform in an attempt to end the disproportionate policing against Black Portlanders. Protesters spoke with Ryan outside his home last week after he, along with Fritz and Wheeler, postponed the vote on the police budget amendment due to needing more information. Last night, some protesters threw eggs at Ryan's darkened home, while others lit flares and shattered a window on the property. Police quickly announced an unlawful assembly and ordered folks to disperse. Though Ryan has not yet commented, yesterday's actions brought a swift condemnation from other city commissioners. Newly reelected Mayor Wheeler said, quote, "Those responsible must be found, investigated, and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. I condemn anyone who uses violence to attempt to silence the voices of others." The PPB budget reduction had been proposed by Commissioner Hardesty and was supported by outgoing Commissioner Chloe Udaly. But despite losing the vote, Hardesty also had some words for the protesters, saying, quote, "I want to be clear. We can disagree and be upset over these issues, but I do not condone what took place at the commissioner's home last night, and those who engaged in the acts need to be held responsible. Fighting for systemic change is messy and complicated, but what shouldn't be complicated is recognizing when lines have been crossed, and that's what happened last night." The Portland Police Union filed a grievance with the city on Thursday, challenging the legality of Measure 26217. The challenge came just 2 days after Portland voters overwhelmingly approved the measure, calling for a new independent police oversight system. The Portland Police Association represents about 850 officers, sergeants, and detectives. In their grievance, they contend that any changes impacting police policies, investigations, and job security must be negotiated. The filing cited past rulings by the State Employment Relations Board in 2010 and 2016 that rejected city attempts to, quote, evade its bargaining obligations regarding pension benefits. In those rulings, the Employment Board said putting those questions before the voters without reaching union agreement constitutes bad faith. Measure 26217 passed with roughly 82% support in Tuesday's election and amends Portland's city charter to create a new commission of civilian volunteers. The commission would have the power to investigate incidents involving deadly force by officers, as well as allegations of police misconduct. The powers to discipline or even fire officers has been previously reserved for the police commissioner, who, as of this point, is still Mayor Wheeler, and is the driving point for the union. Voter approval of Measure 26217 comes following months of nightly racial justice protests where multiple counts of officer misconduct are currently under review. Local lawmakers weighed in on the newly passed measure, with recently reelected Mayor Ted Wheeler saying, quote, "The people have spoken. The city will actively defend the voters' decision and comply with the charter amendment to meet any bargaining obligations required by law." Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, a longtime proponent of police reform, had pushed to get the measure on the ballot and maintained that to fully realize her goal of effective and transparent police oversight, state laws and the union's contracts both need to be changed. The grievance was sent to Police Bureau Deputy Chief Chris Davis on Thursday, signed by newly appointed union president Brian Hensiker, who took over the police union's top spot on November 1st. Since being allowed to cover their name tags, Portland Police Bureau officers working the nightly protests have only been identified by the numbers on their helmets, and Officer 67 of the Bureau's rapid response team quickly became notorious among protesters for his violent behavior. Officer 67 has now been identified as Detective Eric Kammerer, a 26-year veteran of the PPB. He was pulled from the rapid response team last month after a Willamette Week story detailed his questionable actions during multiple incidents reaching back to late June. On September 6th, Kammerer is alleged to have struck Black homeowner Elijah Warren from behind when the Southeast Portland homeowner approached officers to talk about tear gas entering his home. The unprovoked attack landed Warren in the hospital. Citing the police contract and legal advice from city attorneys, the mayor and other city officials repeatedly refused to divulge Officer 67's name. But several witnesses have now identified Kammerer. An ACLU spokesperson, Doug Brown, is certain that Kammerer and Officer 67 are one and the same. Speaking to Willamette Week, Brown said, quote, "It's 100% him, in the same way a quarter is 25 cents." According to the mayor's office, the actions of Officer 67 are currently under investigation. Spokesperson Jim Middaugh said, quote, "The complaints raised by Willamette Week and others about individual police officers currently are under active investigation." Yesterday, the United States set another record for COVID-19 cases with over 121,000 new infections reported. The record number came the day after hitting 100,000 for the first time. In Oregon, 805 new cases were recorded, exceeding the previous high by well over 200. And although the growth rate in Oregon is still much lower than other states, the increase prompted Oregon Governor Kate Brown to announce new actions at a 1 p.m. press conference today. She noted that the increase was not linked to large outbreaks, but was widely distributed and decentralized. Counties with high growth rates will be asked to, quote, take a two-week pause. That pause includes restrictions to visiting long-term care facilities, reducing indoor restaurants to a maximum of 50 people, including staff, limiting table seatings to 6 people or less. Outdoor dining is not restricted beyond the standard 6-foot social distance requirements. Reducing all indoor recreation facilities, such as gyms, health clubs, and museums, to a maximum capacity of 50 people. And mandating that wherever possible, businesses require their staff to work from home. The pause starts Wednesday and initially includes Malheur, Umatilla, Marion, Jackson, and Multnomah counties. Despite repeated assurances from President Trump that we were rounding the corner on the virus, the U.S. has seen a 54% increase in cases nationwide and an 8% increase in deaths over just the last 2 weeks. A Troutdale man was arrested by the FBI on Thursday and faces federal charges of terrorism following allegations that he aided the Islamic State for years and contributed to foreign terrorist organizations while trying to become a U.S. citizen. 31-year-old Hawazin Samir Mothafar pleaded not guilty before a federal magistrate judge on Thursday morning. He faces 5 charges of conspiracy by providing support to ISIS and producing and distributing ISIS propaganda and recruiting materials. Mothafar also pleaded not guilty to charges of making false statements on an immigration application and making false statements to a government agency. A federal indictment is accusing Mothafar of advocating jihad in the online Arabic newspaper Al-Anaj, a pro-ISIS publication that is produced by Sunni Shield, a pro-ISIS internet-based media organization. Among the articles that prosecutors say Mothafar created and distributed are titles such as Effective Stabbing Techniques and How to Best Kill and Maim in a Knife Attack, as well as a video tutorial called How Does a Detonator Work? The indictment also alleges he had been working with, contributing to, and editing for Al-Duras Al-Sunni site since February of 2015. If convicted, Mothafar faces a maximum sentence of 35 years in prison. Mothafar is a legal permanent resident and spoke in Arabic through a translator and his court-appointed attorney to enter his not guilty plea and request for jury trial on Thursday. Prosecutors did not ask that Mothafar be detained, but agreed to limitations on travel and use of electronic devices, also saying if circumstances change, the court may seek his future detention. Once again, the polls were wrong, and Donald Trump pulled a surprisingly high percentage of votes in on Tuesday's election. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
Let's do a thought experiment. Imagine you had a hateful old man as your next-door neighbor. He cheats on his wife, is constantly complaining about foreigners and uppity women. He tells bald-faced lies to everyone in the neighborhood, and your auto mechanic has told you that he refuses to pay his repair bills. Would you let this man babysit your kids? Would you let him look after your dogs? Hell, would you even let him in your house? You may not, but as of the latest vote count, we've learned that about 70 million of our fellow Americans have decided that a man of that character is worthy to be their president for another 4 years. They not only invited him in, they're letting him manage their house. To me, this is nearly inconceivable. His character was actually on full display for all to see well before the 2016 election, and initially I harshly judged those who were willing to look past those obvious character flaws and vote for him anyway. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that many of those voters had never recovered from the Great Recession, and they were desperate for a leadership change that would help them. Unlike Hillary Clinton, they probably viewed him as the outsider who was going to shake things up. They may have believed he really was going to drain a swamp. They may have believed he could bring back jobs from overseas. They may have believed he was going to replace Obamacare with something even better. And although I couldn't understand it, I was willing to give most Trump voters a pass at that time. But that was then. Now there's no excuse. For 4 years, we've listened to a litany of thousands of lies and watched him proudly wear racism and misogyny like a badge of honor as he dog-whistled his alt-right army of fanatics. His tax cut to the rich has created a $1 trillion debt and ensured that the standard of living will continue to get worse for our children and grandchildren. Hundreds of thousands have died due to his inept response to the coronavirus. We've seen him lead his hateful rallies, insult America's friends around the world, cozy up to dictators, and bail out of the climate accords while doubling down on fossil fuels. All this while leading the most corrupt administration in our history. It's clear that he shouldn't be president. He should be in prison. So if you're a Trump voter, what's your excuse this time? And if the defense is that you've always voted Republican or that you think Joe Biden is a socialist, forget it. You could have voted for all your down-ballot Republicans and left the presidential vote blank. If you voted for Trump this time, you voted for greed, hatred, and the acceleration of a dying planet. If you consciously voted for Trump this time, you showed your true colors, and it's not a good look. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect a clear evening with an overnight low in the high 30s. And tomorrow, we can look forward to a partly cloudy day with a high near 50. On this day in 1973, Coleman Young became the first African-American mayor of Detroit, Michigan. Today's quote is from Coleman Young. He said, quote, "Swearing is an art form. You can express yourself much more exactly, much more succinctly, with properly used curse words." Last night, an increasingly desperate Donald Trump stood in the White House briefing room and for 17 minutes claimed that the election was being stolen from him. Without evidence, the president claimed that Democrats, the media, pollsters, and big tech companies were all working together corruptly to deny him a second term, saying, quote, "They're trying to rig an election, and we can't let that happen." Many news organizations chose to cut away from the president's comments, pointing out that many of his comments were simply untrue, and even longtime supporters questioned his claims. Former New Jersey governor and Trump ally Chris Christie said, quote, "As a former U.S. attorney, there's no basis to make that argument tonight." On CNN, former Republican Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania called Trump's comments dangerous and shocking and stated, quote, counting ballots and mail-in ballots is not fraud. Longtime Republican strategist Karl Rove said, quote, stealing hundreds of thousands of votes would require a conspiracy on the scale of a James Bond movie. That isn't going to happen. The ultra-conservative New York Post ran an article under the headline, Downcast Trump Makes Baseless Election Fraud Claims in White House Address, and even Fox News pointed out that there was no evidence of voter fraud. Normally mild-mannered Anderson Cooper of CNN summed up the president's briefing by saying, quote, that is the most powerful person in the world, and we see him like an obese turtle on his back, flailing in the hot sun, realizing his time is over. While the states continue to count votes, President Trump prematurely declared victory while Joe Biden urged patience. With more on the story and others, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
We need to make sure that the structures of our democracy, even with all their weaknesses and flaws, be protected and then built upon.
With some elections still in doubt, there are lawsuits in the courts and protesters in the streets, most Biden supporters in favor of counting every vote no matter what, and some Trump supporters going in either direction depending on what might help the president. Leslie Kagan is a New York City organizer with the Protect the Results Coalition.
One foundational piece of that is that everybody who is eligible to vote should vote, of course, and then every vote must be counted.
The electoral vote count is close, but former Vice President Joe Biden is decidedly ahead in the popular vote. More Americans have voted for a Democratic president in 7 of the last 8 elections. The nation is watching close counts in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, and Nevada. Former Vice President Joe Biden made a point to reassure voters that the extra time taken means the process is working.
Democracy is sometimes messy. It sometimes requires a little patience as well.
President Donald Trump, on the other hand, tried to claim victory again.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win.
Trump took to Twitter to threaten more legal action without basis for what he calls voter and state election fraud, but only in the, quote, recent Biden-claimed states. Twitter flagged that tweet, along with almost 40% of Trump's tweets since Wednesday morning, for containing possibly misleading information about the electoral process. The Trump campaign has lost a couple of those lawsuits already. Yesterday, a Michigan judge rejected the request to halt the count there. And in Georgia, a judge dismissed a lawsuit alleging that officials in Chatham County mishandled ballots, citing lack of evidence. Gabriel Sterling is with the Georgia Secretary of State's office.
The outcome will be whatever the voters of Georgia have chosen. And yes, it's a tight race. So be patient. The outcome will be certified. We will have an audit, so we will all know that the outcome is correct.
In Nevada, though, the Trump campaign announced a new federal lawsuit alleging Clark County, home to Las Vegas, is counting, quote, illegal votes after the state Supreme Court declined to stop the count. Joe Gloria is registrar of voters there.
My response is that we are not aware of any improper ballots that are being processed.
Nevada accepts ballots postmarked by Election Day as long as they're received by the following week. With 6 electoral votes, it's one of the last states yet to be called.
Our goal here in Clark County is not to count fast. We want to make sure that we're being accurate. The results in the state of Nevada obviously are going to be very important to the entire country, and that is our number one goal.
And 20 Republican former U.S. attorneys called Trump's claims, quote, premature, baseless, and reckless yesterday, rebuking his attempts to delegitimize results that aren't in his favor. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service and produced for television by Free Speech TV, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
The Navajo Nation in Arizona is imposing a tight curfew system in an attempt to slow down the coronavirus. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As COVID-19 cases rise across Navajo land in a second wave, the tribal government is switching from weekend lockdowns with all stores closed to a curfew system. Emma Gibson with Arizona Public Media has more.
The curfew allows essential businesses, such as grocery stores and laundromats, to open from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. during the first 2 weekends of November. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez says he hopes it brings down COVID-19 cases by reducing the need for travel.
We are hearing reports that on the weekends, people that are needing essentials leave the Navajo Nation to border towns, and border towns don't have the stringent protocols that Navajo businesses do.
Nez says businesses in the nation must conduct temperature checks, and among other things, everyone must wear a mask. So far, he says there have been fewer cases reported during this surge than there were in the first wave. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
The Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico is preparing for a 14-day lockdown due to COVID-19. President Gabe Aguilar informed the community in a video message that cases are getting higher on the reservation.
A lot of people have been asking for a lockdown. We have been talking about it. We have been doing everything we could to try to avoid the lockdown. But for us to slow the spread, it's going to take all of us to do our part. All of us to not visit with our families, because what we're finding out from IHS is that a lot of people that are getting positive, it's not coming from work at the end. It's coming when you're home and you take your mask off and you're having guests and you're having visitors. So please, please stay home, protect your family, and let's get through this together.
Tribal roads will be closed off and guarded. All reservation residents are to stay home except for essential workers. The Tribal Emergency Command Center will be open to assist people with emergency needs. The two-week lockdown begins Monday. The first bison are on the ground at a new range in south-central South Dakota. Seth Tupper of South Dakota Public Broadcasting reports.
Wizipon Little Elk says there's a deep meaning underlying the project and its Lakota language name.
Our project is called Wolakota, and what that means in our language is to live the Lakota way of life. Our identity is linked from the health and welfare and well-being of buffalo. And when they're strong, we're going to be strong again as well.
Little Elk is the CEO of the Rosebud Economic Development Corporation on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. The corporation is converting 40 square miles of ranch land on the reservation into a massive buffalo range. They're working with the World Wildlife Fund and getting excess bison from federal government herds. The first buffalo arrived recently, 50 from Badlands National Park, and another 50 from Theodore Roosevelt National Park. T.J. Heinert is a range assistant with the project.
Being Native and what they stand for us, I mean, it's a powerful feeling that you can't even really explain. It's so electrifying. Once they're actually there, you're looking at them, you hear them, you see them move. I mean, they're an amazing animal.
Rotational grazing will keep buffalo moving throughout the range. Range manager Jimmy Doyle says that mimics the way buffalo moved across the plains.
This will be a really neat opportunity to kind of showcase the ecological benefits of well-managed grazing, but doing it with basically the original tool that did it in the first place.
The corporation wants to grow the herd to 1,500 animals. I'm Seth Tupper.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
30,000 Iowa felons had their voting rights restored, but with a short sign-up window, only about 10% exercised their right. For more on that, here's Mike Moen with the Public News Service.
Prior to the November election, Iowans with past felony convictions were given the opportunity to vote. However, only a small number registered, and advocates point to a short time frame while hoping for more outreach in future elections. Late this summer, Governor Kim Reynolds signed an order that restored the voting rights of more than 30,000 people who had completed their sentences. Results are incomplete, but early data show only 3,300 registered. State Representative-elect Christina Bohannon was among those trying to raise awareness. She says timing was a factor because the order was signed in August. But she also wonders if the Secretary of State and other agencies could have done a more targeted outreach.
My sense is that there just was not a significant effort to really make people's rights known, and that it came pretty late in the game to really try to do something for this election.
She says mailings sent out were not specific enough and might not have reached all those eligible because it's possible their address wasn't current. However, the Secretary of State says it did heavy media promotion while making numerous resources available, including a specific website for residents who fall under this category. Michelle Hines runs the Johnson County Group Inside Out Reentry Community, which serves those returning to society after incarceration. She says most of the people they assist aren't eligible because they're still on parole, but she says when notifying those who did qualify, there was some confusion.
Very few actually knew that they were eligible and that understood the full eligibility if they were aware of it. So there seemed to be a real kind of that information disconnect.
Hines adds that most people who are eligible are no longer served by groups like hers and are focused on their daily lives. She suggests that's where the state can step in by getting the message out in a broader way. Bohannon adds there can't be assumptions that everyone who qualifies will go to the website. She adds there are other ways to establish a broader outreach.
Working with the Department of Corrections to try to see whether we have any current contact information for folks.
She says that could be beneficial in making more connections through the mail. The Corrections Department did not respond to a request for comment before deadline. Meanwhile, Bohannon is hopeful advocacy groups will have more time for coordinated outreach when municipal elections are held next year. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
With many protesters out on the streets, they're reminded of their rights and how to avoid violent confrontations. With more on that, here's Mary Sherman with the Public News Service.
Social justice groups are reminding Illinoisans about their rights when it comes to defending democracy. Historic numbers of voters cast ballots in the 2020 presidential election, and counts still are being finalized across the country. Activists in Illinois and other states are taking to the streets calling for every vote to be counted. As director of the American Friends Service Committee's Chicago Peace Building Project, Mary Zirkel encourages peaceful protest and offers some advice.
Stay with your buddies, don't talk to the police, and don't engage any counter-protesters that might be nearby, even though that can be very tempting sometimes. And if you see violence happening and you can find a place to exit the situation, that's always a good thing to do.
Zirkel says it's also important to respect the rights of other protesters by not photographing anyone without permission and not policing their behavior. She explains.